Psalms of confidence. Turn to Psalm 16. We'll look at two of these that should be pretty familiar. The easy description for a psalm of confidence is that it is a hymn without the structure. You remember that hymns were expressions of praise. Hymns were positive reflections on God's character and God's actions. But hymns had a very specific order, right? And we talked about this is the way that hymns are laid out, and you could see that across the various hymns. Psalms of confidence are psalms that are filled with expressions of trust in God, of confidence in God, and yet they don't have any particular structure. They're expressions of hope. As I said a few moments ago, they're realistic expressions of hope. They're not all positive. They're not simply everything about life is good and perfect, and therefore God is good and perfect. But they are expressions that, come what may, God is faithful, God is able, and so we have hope. They're not dealing with a specific moment of trouble or a specific moment of anxiety. They deal with the concept that trouble and anxiety can and do exist in this world, and so we should be confident at all times. We don't just need to be confident when everything's going poorly. We need to be confident when everything's going well also. Confident in God rather than in ourselves. So as you look at Psalm 16, "Preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge." Now right there, you get reality. If you need a place in which to seek refuge, you are admitting that life is full of storms, that life has difficulties, that life has trials. So again, it's not denying the reality of hardship. It's admitting it. Even though they're not in a specific moment of hardship, or there's not one in mind, "Preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good apart from you. As for the saints in the land, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. The sorrows of those who run after another god shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out or take their names on my lips. There are idolaters in the world, those who chase false gods. The Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. You hold my lot. I will pursue you rather than the idols of idolaters. I will pursue you. I will be satisfied with you. You will be my portion. I don't need to go chasing after these other things. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance." When I look at the whole of my life, it's blessing. It's good. It's not that my life is without trial. It's not that my life is without adversity. But the boundary lines for me, this concept of when you go make a claim for land in the ancient world, nobody owned the land. It's not like you were buying it from a previous owner, right? You're going out into wilderness that's not owned by anybody. But there would be structures that would be set up, what we would call in the government, that would determine what people's boundary lines were, what property they would claim as their own. Would it be good, fertile soil? Would it have sources of water? Would it be useful, or would it be barren wasteland, land that nobody wanted? So this concept of "the lines have fallen in pleasant places for me" is that idea of the territory of my life. Not every square inch, but the territory of my life is a pleasant one. I can see aspects of God's blessing. I can see His favor when I look at the big picture. I have a beautiful inheritance. "I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. In the night also, my heart instructs me." Life has challenges. Life has problems. Life has issues that need to be sorted out. There are decisions that need to be made. There are complicated choices that we have to make throughout our lives. But what David reflects on is that the Lord doesn't leave him in the dark. The Lord instructs him. The Lord gives him wisdom. The Lord gives him idea as to what to do. The Lord gives him truth. "I have set the Lord always before me. Because He is at my right hand, I shall not be shaken." This is the whole theme of this morning's sermon. If you fear God, you have nothing else to fear. It's a reality. If God is your strength, There's nothing that can overwhelm God, and so there's nothing that can overwhelm you. And so in reflection upon that, he says, therefore my heart is glad. My whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. Having a confident hope, which is the only kind of true Christian hope. Hope in general use is a wish. Boy, I really hope the Braves win the pennant this year. Well, that's a wish. But the kind of hope that is Christian hope is the assurance. It is absolute certainty that because God has declared it, we can know for certain what is in the future. And if you have that, if you are certain that God is who He says He is and that He will do what He says He will do, you will never be afraid of anything else. But what's the worst that can happen? This is the argument that Jesus makes. What's the worst that can happen? Somebody can steal your stuff, but it all belongs to my Father. My Father will pay you back. He will reward you. What's the worst that can happen? Somebody can hurt you physically? Oh no, they can kill you. But my Father is the one who can give everlasting life. My Father is the one who makes all things new. Why would you worry about those things? So David has this pattern that if your flesh dwells secure, if you have this absolute hope, your heart is glad. Your whole being rejoices. That's all tied together. Our experience of anxiety in this life is directly connected to our trust that God will do what He says He will do. It's a one-to-one correspondence. People who talk about worry or anxiety as a generational sin or a generational curse. I come from a long line of folks who claim that there is a generational curse of anxiety in our families. It's lack of faith. It's not believing that God will do what He says He was going to do. And that seems harsh when you say it because, well, some people just by nature are prone to... Yeah, some people just by nature are prone to the sin of worry. We're prone to lots of sins. I could make my list for you on the board. Wouldn't be a lot of fun for me, but we could do it. Some of us are prone to the sin of worry. That's what it is. And just because it's a socially acceptable sin doesn't make it any less sinful. If we trust in God that He will do what He said He was going to do, we don't need to fear anything else. That's not pie in the sky. That's not burying our heads in the sand. That is believing that God is sovereign over every single thing. All those things we worry about and all those things that we fear and all those things that we project out into the future. Here's what's going to happen and here's what's going to go wrong. That is a denial that God is sovereign. Oh God, you might be sovereign, but you can't control those things. What if that happens? It's lack of faith. If we have that faith, our hearts will be glad, our whole beings will rejoice. This is, I think, something that a place where Christians ought to have demonstrably different lives than unbelievers. This is one of the ways that we can most easily model the benefits of Christianity for an unbelieving world, is that we recognize the reality of suffering and of hardship, but we do it without fear. That would be a pretty remarkable difference for many in this world. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol or let your Holy One see corruption. That's why David's not worried about it. What's the worst thing they can do? Jesus said, fear the one who after killing you can cast you into hell. That's the one you worry about. And David says, that's not going to happen to me. You will not abandon my soul. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. So what does this psalm express? It expresses personal security in God. Gratitude for the blessings that God gives, that He gives instruction, that He gives a pleasant life, that He gives joy, that He gives counsel, that He gives gladness of heart. It expresses hope and confidence in what God will do. And these are the expressions of joy that come from Christian hope. And that's what Psalms of Confidence are. There's no outline that we can point to that says this is how they work. They're just unrestrained expressions of hope and confidence in who God is and what He will do and the way we can live because of our faith in that. Turn to the most famous psalm of confidence, Psalm 23. Does this psalm deny the reality of suffering and hardship in this world? No. Walking through the valley of the shadow of death doesn't sound like a great deal of fun to me. And yet, what does it say? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. That's an important connection, that one of the ways, and remember that we don't confuse justification and sanctification. Behavior is not a prerequisite for salvation. Behavior is a result of salvation. But the Proverbs and the Psalms and all of Scripture very closely tie together righteousness with peace and security and blessing. One of the means, one of the things that God uses to give us a pleasant life is obedience. He shows us the way of righteousness, and if we will follow the way of righteousness, things will be better for us. That's the reality. That's the way God has orchestrated the world. And so he doesn't just say, you know, the Lord is my shepherd. He gives me blessing after blessing after blessing for no reason at all. He says, look at one of the means that God uses. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Now, there's a line that children don't like to hear very much, is it? The thought of being comforted by a rod and a staff. Have you ever watched a shepherd, an actual shepherd, shepherd sheep? It's a fascinating thing to observe, isn't it, Phil?
I watched it in Jordan on the plains of the desert as they were bringing the sheep back.
It is a brutal endeavor. In their effort to protect the sheep, and to sheep are dumb. If you've ever spent any time around sheep, I spent some time around sheep.
Or watch Babe.
We watch a lot of Babe in our house. Singing sheep particularly. Sheep are dumb. You can put a sheep within 50 feet of a food source or a water source, and it will stand there and stare at you and starve to death or die of dehydration. Sheep are dumb, dumb creatures. And so that's why God refers to us as sheep. Yeah. There's lots of good parallels there. How do you lead sheep? Well, it's quite brutal to watch. The rod and the staff. Sometimes you can try to nudge a sheep. One other thing that people don't know about sheep, if you haven't been around them much, they are massive animals. It is not like a fluffy bunny rabbit. Sheep are, as we would say in the South, thick. They are big boned. They are solid creatures. They weigh a lot. And so you can try to poke at them with your staff if you want to, but most likely you're just going to have to beat them to get them to move the direction they want. And a shepherd's staff has a hook on the end so that you can grab them by the neck and nudge them this way to get them to go the right direction. It's a painful endeavor. You have to inflict a little bit of pain for the sheep's own good, because it'll stand over there and starve to death or die of dehydration unless you can get it where the food or the water is obviously in front of it. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Oh, that's nice. God is with us in difficulty, whispering sweet nothings and saying pleasant things to us. For your rod and your staff, they comfort me. This is right in line with the Bible's teaching about discipline, which is that you discipline the ones that you love. A Christian author who writes on the family very well wrote at one point that refusal to discipline a child is a slow, hateful way of disowning them. And that's the sense in which David can say that the Lord's discipline, the Lord's rod and his staff, comfort, because they're expressions of his love. I will cause these little bits of pain if that is what moves you to safety and security and everlasting life. I'll do it. And so for David to call those things comfort is really remarkable. But it's not all discipline, is it? That's not the only tool God uses. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forevermore. My lines have fallen in pleasant places. Sometimes I'm walking through the valley of the shadow of death. Sometimes I need the Lord's rod and staff to save me, much less comfort me. But life is not all that. Life is filled with pleasantness and with blessings and with joy and with fruitful endeavors and with happiness. My cup overflows. It's a very balanced, reasonable view of life. It's not pretending, as we'll talk about in the sermon this morning. So that's Psalm 23. That's another psalm of confidence. And these are wonderful examples of psalms that give us the opportunity to reflect on the whole of life, the good and the bad, and how God is with us and for us in all of it. He's even for us with the rod and the staff. If he fails to discipline, he fails to love. And that's something to keep in mind. So